If you have any questions about that, our first speaker, Grant Smith, founder and director of AIRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, has in fact written a book about the spy trade disagreement. It is called Spy Trade, and I'm sure he'll be happy to answer any questions during the question period. He's going to lead off our panel by describing ongoing investigations and cover-ups of how weapons-grade uranium and critical dual-use technology were illegally diverted to Israel from a factory in Pennsylvania where it may have played a critical role in the development of Israel's nuclear weapons industry. Grant Smith is the author of several important books that document the activities of AIPAC, its American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and its predecessors, including Deadly Dogma, How Neoconservatives Broke the Law to Deceive America, Foreign Agents, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the 1963 Fulbright hearings to the 2005 espionage scandal, America's Defense Line, the Justice Department's battle to register the Israel lobby as agents of a foreign government, and spy trade.
Like Jeff, I like show and tell. And after 32 years, on May 6, 2010, something rather amazing happened. The Government Accountability Office partially declassified and released a document that had been kept under wraps for about 32 years, in spite of the best efforts of researchers to dislodge it. It bears the tantalizing title of Nuclear Diversion in the U.S., question mark, 13 years of contradiction and confusion. Although it's been partially declassified, the researchers' quest for more information about the U.S.-Israel nuclear relationship and dislodging secrets is far from over. I'll be using this document and referring back to it at various moments as I walk through my presentation. You can find it easily now by simply Googling nuclear diversion, and it's usually one of the top two results. We'll explore the mechanisms and policies that have offshored one of the most awesome military powers ever devised by man, first unleashed by the United States, and how coerced ambiguity about Israel's nuclear arsenal undermines accountability here in the United States. It undermines rule of law. It undermines governance. And of course, as Jeff mentioned, this issue could not be more timely since major mainstream news outlets are trumpeting Obama's apparent acquiescence to maintaining, quote-unquote, strategic ambiguity in the wake of the Netanyahu visit. Since few Americans are aware of how heavily Israel relied on weapons stolen and smuggled from the United States in the past, I'd like to do a small review. In 1945, David Ben-Gurion traveled to the United States under the auspices of the Jewish Agency, which remains today one of the largest global nonprofits in the world, financing and managing immigration and settlement to Israel. Ben-Gurion held a secret meeting in June of 1945 in the apartment of Rudolf Sonneborn, gathering together 18 wealthy North American donors for his upcoming fight for independence. He solicited arms and financing. Michael Karpin reveals in his book, The Bomb in the Basement, that the donations coordinator was none other than Henry Morgenthau Jr., who had served 11 years as Secretary of Treasury in the Roosevelt administrations. Morgenthau resigned from government soon after Harry S. Truman entered office to serve as chairman of the United Jewish Appeal and later chairman of the Board of Governors of the American Financial Development Corporation for Israel. The conventional arms smuggling network racked up an impressive record, buying for pennies on the dollar, or simply stealing in some cases, explosives, small arms, heavy machine guns, munitions-making equipment, aircraft, ships, and tanks destined for civilian conversion, well, probably not for tanks, or in many uses, simply scrap under the auspices of the War Assets Administration. which was in charge of decommissioning America's immense World War II military surplus. The definitive account of this is Leonard Slater's book, The Pledge, 1970, and subsequent reports based on CIA declassification, such as Ricky Dale Calhoun's scholarly paper, The Haganah's Illegal Arms Procurement Network in the U.S. In 1958, then Israeli Prime Minister Ben-Gurion arranged for clothing magnate Abraham Feinberg to secretly finance nuclear weapons programs in Israel, among other benedictors in the United States, according to Abner Cohen's indispensable book, Israel and the Bomb. Feinberg, a major Democratic Party donor, had organized President Harry S. Truman's whistle-stop fundraising campaign, which saved his presidential bid from certain disaster. David Lowenthal, formerly a member of the underground Haganah, fought during Israel's 1948 War of Independence under Meir Amit, who later became head of Israeli intelligence. Lowenthal, also a close friend of David Ben-Gurion, provided the venture capital to finance the purchase of the Apollo Steel Company facility in Pennsylvania for $450,000. Dr. Zalman M. Shapiro, an inventor and head of a local Zionist Organization of America chapter, became founder and president of the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation at Apollo, Pennsylvania, in 1956. Lowenthal capitalized NUMEC through a stock offering in 1957, and business took off. He had a highly talented team. NUMEC co-founder Leonard Pepkowitz had worked on the Manhattan Project, building the bomb, and later moved to the Los Alamos Laboratory in New Mexico. According to the secret GAO report, during the course of its operations, NUMEC received more than 22 tons of taxpayer-funded, highly enriched uranium-235, the key ingredient used for manufacturing nuclear weapons. This came from Westinghouse and the U.S. Navy. In the early 1960s, the Atomic Energy Commission began documenting suspicious lapses in NUMEC security, inexplicably lax record-keeping, and the ongoing presence of large numbers of Israelis at the plant. In 1962, the AEC considered suspending classified weapons work at NUMEC. In 1965, an AEC audit found that NUMEC could no longer account for 220 pounds of highly enriched uranium. In 1966, the FBI opened an investigation and began monitoring NUMEC's management and Israeli visitors. On September 10, 1968, four Israelis visited NUMEC to discuss thermoelectric devices with Shapiro. Or at least this was the excuse their security office gave to the AEC, which had to sign off on the event. Among the approved visitors was Raphael Eitan. And at some point after Eitan's visit, 587 pounds of highly enriched uranium was classified as missing. The FBI's initial investigations in the 1960s quickly circled in on NUMEC's management, but the FBI recommendations, according to this report, were stymied. According to the GAO document, quote, the FBI became so concerned about the security risks posed by NUMEC's president that they asked the DOE whether it planned to terminate the security clearance or stop the flow of materials to NUMEC. According to the FBI's liaison with the GAO, the FBI recommended that NUMEC's operating license be taken away, unquote. However, when this request was denied, the FBI simply dropped its investigation between 1969 and 1976. The GAO investigation of NUMEC, dated 1978, came at the request of Congressman John Dingell. The GAO investigators went to awesome lengths to gain direct testimony from FBI and CIA officials and agents with direct first-hand knowledge of what had happened outside formal channels. Former deputy of the CIA's Directorate of Science and Technology, Carl Duckett, said the agency came to the conclusion by 1968 that, quote, the NUMEC material had been diverted by the Israelis and used in fabricating weapons, unquote. When U.S. Navy analyst Jonathan Pollard was arrested spying for Israel in 1985, Raphael Eitan's importance was finally fully understood. In 1986, investigators discovered that Eitan, who entered NUMEC in 1968, had the same birth date, 11-23-1926, as the spy handling Pollard. According to Anthony Cordesman, at that time, he said, quote, there's no conceivable reason for Eitan to have gone to the Apollo plant but for the nuclear material, unquote. Eitan is now well documented as one of Israel's top economic espionage agents for the secretive LACOM, which launched multiple clandestine operations against U.S. military and economic targets. And in the 1980s and 1990s, the U.S. continued to be a relatively easy target. Another GAO report in 1988 determined that the Department of Energy nuclear laboratories were far too open to foreign visitors. Quote, countries identified as sensitive by DOE because there is security and or proliferation risk, such as Pakistan and Israel, unquote. The report found that, quote, of 637 visitors from countries such as India, Israel, and Pakistan, the DOE required background checks for only 77, unquote. And in addition to amassing critical knowledge, other nuclear technologies freely flowed from the U.S. to Israel, including dual-use technologies such as klystrons and krytons. In May of 1985, former Air Force and NATO advisor Richard Kelly Smith, no relation, was charged by a federal grand jury with smuggling over 800 krytons to Israel. The kryton can be used to trigger nuclear weapons. Federal law forbade their sale overseas without a permit. At the time of his arrest, Smith was president of an export and engineering business in Huntington Beach, California, named Milco International Corporation. Milco provided aviation consulting through U.S. military contracts as well as sales and export facilitation. Milco had close ties with Aaron Milchan. In the early 80s, billionaire Aaron Milchan did not seem like a likely candidate for any involvement in nuclear technology smuggling. He's a dual citizen of Israel and Monaco and close personal friend of Shimon Peres, which is a common denominator in many of these nuclear initiatives. Milchan was most widely known in the U.S. as a Hollywood film mogul. Smith jumped bail and disappeared overseas for more than a decade. Afterwards, Milchan publicly denied that he had done anything illegal during interviews with NBC News in 1982 and 1993. But in July of 2001, Smith was arrested in Costa del Sol in Malaga, Spain, and at the age of 72, extradited back to the United States and held without bail for trial in California. He was found guilty of violating Arms Export Control Act and issuing false statements to government agencies, fined $20,000 and sentenced to 40 months in federal prison. But the big operators behind that operation walked free. This has been the recurring theme of arms and technology smuggling to Israel. Some speculate, including this GAO report, which again, I advise everyone to read, it's fascinating stuff, whether it says, quote, the material was diverted to Israel by NUMEC management with the assistance of the Central Intelligence Agency, or, quote, again from this report, there has been a cover-up of the NUMEC incidents by the United States government. Milchan stated, before Smith was extradited back to the United States, that, quote, there's nothing that the U.S. and Israel do separately, unquote. But he's since gone silent about the krytons. So the question is, has the United States officially, yet secretly, been arming Israel with nuclear weapons technology? There is no evidence of that yet. In the early 1960s, as the problems for NUMEC were beginning, President John F. Kennedy, and this is something Jeff referred to, was unleashing not only a robust nuclear non-proliferation initiative, heavily targeting the Israelis, but also a law enforcement and accountability maneuver. He not only demanded U.S. inspections of the Dimona nuclear weapons plant, but on November 21, 1962, his brother, Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, ordered Israel's elite American lobby to register as foreign agents under the Foreign Agents Registration Act after the American Zionist Council was discovered laundering tax-exempt Jewish agency funds into U.S. lobbying and public relations campaign. The full Department of Justice case file on that was declassified and released by the National Archives in 2008, and it now appears on the internet if you simply search for American Zionist Council. During a December 27, 1962 meeting with Foreign Minister Golda Meir, Kennedy expressed his hope that the relationship was, quote, a two-way street, unquote. Meir reassured the president that there would, quote, not be any difficulty between us on the Israeli nuclear reactor, unquote. Kennedy delivered an ultimatum to Israel on July 5, 1963, insisting that Dimona undergo serial inspections, quote, in accord with international standards, unquote, in order to verify its peaceful intent. This occurred as a letter-writing campaign organized by the American Council for Judaism was bombarding the Kennedy Justice Department with telegrams urging that the American Zionist Council be forced to register as a foreign agent. On October 11, 1963, the DOJ gave the American Zionist Council a 72-hour deadline to register as Israel's foreign agent. Kennedy's assassination in November not only traumatized the nation, but led to the gradual reversal of both the non-proliferation effort as applied to Israel and foreign agent registration drive. Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion's secret 1958 arrangement with Abraham Feinberg now placed Israel's key nuclear weapons benedictor in the heart of the Johnson administration. According to Seymour Hersh's excellent book, The Samson Option, quote, "There's no question that Feinberg enjoyed the greatest presidential access and influence in his 20 years as a fundraiser and lobbyist with Lyndon Johnson. Documents at the Johnson Library show that even the most senior members of the National Security Council understood that any issue raised by Feinberg had to be answered," unquote. As with Truman, Feinberg played a timely and powerful role in financing Lyndon B. Johnson's election prospects. Scrutiny of Israel's nuclear weapons program gradually reversed, and the Dimona inspections regime, as documented by Cohen, soon became an embarrassing farce for both the United States and Israel. Feinberg's cash was king in the Johnson administration. As documented by Hersh, on October 14, 1964, less than 3 weeks before presidential elections, Johnson's top administrative assistant, Walter Jenkins, was arrested in a public restroom on sexual solicitation charges. At least $250,000 Feinberg had raised for Johnson was located in Jenkins' office safe. Johnson phoned his trusted aides, Bill Moyers and Meyer Feldman, were ordered to move all the cash, which they could only do with a heavy briefcase. In a kind of ongoing global swap, Israel replenished Feinberg's coffers, as it arranged with Zalman Shapiro through sales commissions, with multi-million dollar favors, such as a major ownership interest in Israel's Coca-Cola franchise. In 1968, Hersh documents that Secretary of Defense Clark Clifford placed a final urgent call to Johnson, stating, quote, "Mr. President, I don't want to live in a world where the Israelis have nuclear weapons," unquote. But it was too late. President Johnson was abrupt before he hung up on Clifford, saying, "Don't bother me with this anymore." By the time Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir lobbied President Nixon to define the U.S. non-proliferation policy with an exemption of ambiguity toward Israeli nuclear weapons, Israel's stockpile and number of deployed weapons was steadily growing. So the question is, why don't any of these high-level operators ever go to jail for this kind of behavior in the United States? Why are they above the law? Few perpetrators of highly illegal conventional and nuclear smuggling activities for Israel have ever faced any meaningful consequences. The organizations and individuals of the 1940s Sonobor Institute Haganah Conventional Arms Smuggling Network engaged in charitable activities and had front companies to cover war materiel theft and smuggling. They intertwined with sympathetic elites across U.S. politics, business, and government, which is made it all but impossible as a target for law enforcement. After some Sonobor Network members were arrested in Canada moving machine gun parts across the Canadian border, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police made a recommendation to the FBI that they should make some arrests and investigations. In 1947, leaders of the work network then traveled with a high-level Jewish agency representative to Washington, D.C., and met with Robert R. Nathan, who had led the U.S. industrialization and mobilization, industrial mobilization World War II, becoming the War Production Board's chairman in 1942. And Nathan brokered a summit with FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, again, had, quote, "already asked the FBI to cooperate in tracking down the sources and personnel involved and maybe prosecuting," unquote. But this law enforcement initiative represented a major threat to the Sonneberg Network and the Jewish Agency. Nathan flatly told the FBI director that the network's activities were not all, quote, "anything damaging to the United States, but it's not straight up and above board. Some prominent people and some important organizations could be hurt," unquote. Nathan was presumably referring to Morgenthau, Feinberg, and other key fundraisers, as well as the politicians they patronized so lavishly. Nathan left the meeting feeling the FBI director was sympathetic, but with no indication that Hoover would cooperate. But Nathan turned out to be right, and over time, the criminal records of all the low-level Sonneberg smugglers who were actually caught were expunged. John F. Kennedy pardoned Hank Greenspun in 1961 after winning over Feinberg and the lobby to support his presidential election campaign. Bill Clinton pardoned Al Schwimmer, who smuggled aircraft and later headed up Israeli aircraft industries in the year 2000. Even though Schwimmer never personally applied for a pardon or expressed any contrition for his action, which are usually requirements for a presidential pardon. Charles Winters, the only network member to serve a meaningful prison sentence for smuggling bombers, was posthumously pardoned on December of 2008 by President George W. Bush after an intense lobbying campaign by such prominent Americans as Steven Spielberg, eager to repair the historical record. Pulling out all the stops to spring those accused of wrongdoing is also pretty well documented. In 2009, former NASA scientist Stuart Nozzetti, who held high satellite and nuclear security clearances, was allegedly observed engaged in specific activities or suspicious activities and then stung by the FBI. He allegedly offered to spy for the Mossad in exchange for money. He's currently jailed in extreme conditions that restrict his outside communications. He can't even meet with his wife because she's a lawyer. Nevertheless, before all the facts are known or a trial date set, former AIPAC executive director and Department of Justice employee Neil Scheer has publicly called for an uprising before Nozzetti is prosecuted, urging that, quote, leaders of the Jewish community raise some hell and not show the timidity with which, unfortunately, characterized many responses to the AIPAC case involving Steve Rosen and Keith Weissman, unquote. And I could talk for 3 hours about that, but I won't. And not so publicly, the same lobbying is occurring to correct the historical record on diversions to Israel's nuclear weapons program. Right now, as we speak, and I'll get to that in a moment. But first, what is the cost of strategic ambiguity to Americans? U.S. presidents, including Obama, have generally acquiesced to Israel's demands that its nuclear arsenal never be acknowledged or openly discussed. But strategic ambiguity and secrecy have had devastating effects on rule of law and governance in the United States. Refusing to declassify many key documents under FOIA and mandatory declassification review processes, including appeals to ICECAP, and through lack of candid, honest, and open discussions, U.S. administrations have thwarted informed citizen advice and consent in the process of governance. By refusing to acknowledge Israel's nuclear weapons, as Jeff mentioned, the Symington and Glenn Amendments to the 1961 Foreign Assistance Acts, which banned the country's trafficking in nuclear technologies, have also been thwarted. The will of the people expressed through Congress has been rendered moot. And similarly, American nuclear non-proliferation treaty efforts are considered hypocritical by the rest of the world. On an international level, Israel's arsenal can and has been repeatedly used to extort U.S. conventional military aid and concessions under the threat that Israel would have to resort to its nuclear capability if ever denied. This is well documented as well by Abner Cohen, but using far more diplomatic language. It is this major but generally unmentioned factor in the brewing crisis about Iran's nuclear program. If Americans were properly informed, they might ask whether the current drive to isolate Iran through economic warfare and saber-rattling has as an underlying objective the preservation of Israeli nuclear dominance. Unprosecuted illicit activities in the U.S. that helped create Israel's arsenal, espionage, secrecy, and theft, not only undermined governance in America, but rule of law. If reports about Obama's acquiescence to strategic ambiguity are true, presumably the U.S. government will now retain any key documents that are long overdue for declassification and release. Not for any legitimate reason, but simply because they would prove that sensible policies, including nonproliferation, have been derailed and that our representative form of government has been rendered utterly irrelevant on this question. So strategic ambiguity from this point of view is a cover-up of the privatization or offshoring of America's most closely guarded nuclear force. Obama's new and unprecedented orders for freedom of information will probably no longer apply. The drive to extend the cover-up is now extended beyond the CIA and FBI right into the United States Senate. Last week, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission released documents to me under the Freedom of Information Act. Today you can find them on the IRMEP.org website. On August 27, 2009, Senator Arlen Specter wrote to Rebecca Schmidt asking that the NRC, quote, issue a formal public statement confirming that he, his constituent, Zalman Shapiro, former head of NUMEC, was not involved in any activities related to the diversion of uranium to Israel, unquote. A March 2010 audit by two former NRC officials, which was published in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, confirmed not only that 337 kilograms of New Mech highly enriched uranium are still unaccounted for, but that all the circumstantial evidence still points to diversion to Israel. Last week, Senator Spector's staffer charged with clearing Shapiro confirmed that they're not seeking full release of all FBI and CIA documents about the New Mech diversion, but rather only a formal NRC clearance of Shapiro. To date, to its credit, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has fought back against this campaign, this improper campaign, to absolve New Mech without a full truth commission and release of all related FBI and CIA documents. And that moment of truth is clearly overdue. In closing, the GAO, John Dingell, and Congress always intended that the report, Nuclear Diversion in the U.S., be a public document to spur discussions about questions of diversion and U.S. government involvement. Sections of it are still censored by the CIA and FBI. Americans who understand how ambiguity harms their democratic form of government should reject the suppression of open debate and accountability that are, for us, the core attributes of strategic ambiguity. Thank you.